Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, therapist Fiona Brennan answers a listener dilemma on feeling like the only sibling who takes care of an ageing parent. Comedian Mo Gilligan goes serious with a documentary on fried chicken fast food. And I hear about the health and wellness of a professional ballet dancer. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm good. I feel a bit more like myself this week. That jet lag has finally left me. And it does feel good to be back in a routine of sorts. But like the kids, I'm not really looking forward to the back to school looming. But as I said to my son, please don't spend the last few weeks of the summer holidays counting down. Just enjoy them. And I was on Inishbofin for a few days, and I just think it's so worth a mention because if you haven't been, get it on your list. If you have been, you'll be well aware of the magic of the island. We go with some of our best friends and their families, and we've gone from small kids on the rocks with nets to teens sitting and chatting on the rocks. And it's such a lovely mix of that, of sea swimming, of great food and great crack. We stay in the Dunmore Hotel every time, and I would highly recommend it. They have this amazing way of making you feel like you're staying in their home, even though it's a fully functioning professional hotel. I do love to travel and see the world, and you know I loved my time with my sister, but truly a holiday in Ireland is my favourite. And the way the world is going with climate change, we should all be considering it a lot more. And speaking of, details of my next retreat happening in the Deerstone in Wicklow next May 7th to 9th are on my Instagram at Claire McKenna Presents. You can also email the show aliveandkicking at newstalk.com. Now, Fiona Brennan is back with her Therapy from the Couch series where she answers a listener dilemma. If you'd like to send something in for Fiona to cover another time, you can email aliveandkicking at newstalk.com and we keep everything anonymous. Fiona, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire. Lovely to be with you.
And when you sent this one on to me as a suggestion for the show, this is very common. This is something I hear anecdotally. This is something I see people talk about online a lot. So this is something that you would also see in clinic a good bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Claire. It's something I think so many families really do struggle with. And it's something that I think we need to address the earlier on that we address it, the better.
Well, let me read the email that we received and you can advise us from there. So the emailer says, I'm at the end of my tether, if I'm honest. I'm in my 50s and for the last while, I've been doing the lion's share of caring for my elderly father. I live closer to him than my siblings and I work part time. So somehow it's just become taken for granted that it's up to me. The hospital appointments, checking in on him every day, all of it. He's still very independent, thank God, but he needs the company and I worry about him being isolated. He was so dependent on my mother before she died and now I hate to see him on his own. I have two brothers and a sister and none of them lives that far away, but they're all working full time, very career driven, and it seems to me they think throwing a bit of money at the problem is the solution. Pay for this, pay for that, job done as far as they're concerned. I know that's not fair to say, maybe they do care in their own way, but it doesn't feel like it from where I'm standing. I find myself fuming half the time, stressed and anxious the rest of it. Dad seems to think they're all great and boasts about them all the time, which I find infuriating. I don't want to fall out with my family over this, but I can't keep doing it all either. And it is a really tough time, isn't it? And, you know, in this emailer's case, they have career-driven siblings. Often I see the case if one sibling has a family of their own and young children, and then you have somebody who perhaps didn't have children through choice or otherwise, and it's just assumed that they'll have more free time. So there's a lot of assumption, and it's fair to say that each adult in this situation is doing the best they can and juggling life as best they can, and it's not easy for any of them.
Absolutely, I mean, it's something that I suppose we never, even though we know it's coming, we don't actually really realize it until it's happening, that, you know, we are becoming the carers, if you like, you know, in terms of, you know, the stage of our lives. Once you're in your 50s and parents get older and start to need more care. So I think what we need to do is break it down. So there's five different steps, I think, that are going to help this listener. But first of all, just to explain the psychology behind it, because What's so important is the understanding of the situation. So when one person seems to be just by default the person that is actually taking the lion's share, there's often something more to it than just that. And really, it's about the roles that we play within our families. So this role is almost already predetermined or set, and it's often not a coincidence. For example, you know, this lady shares that she lives closer to her parents. So somewhere along the way, consciously or subconsciously, that was probably a choice that she made. You know, quite often it's the homebird or the person who wants to be close to the family that ends up in that position. So she's someone maybe who adopted that role early on, and now she's kind of, it's just become so intense and it's become magnified. So it's understanding your role and knowing where do you sit within the family, because that helps you to kind of get a picture of why you are where you are, and understanding it is really helpful. So then once you've understood it, let's say that's step one, right? And you want to move away from like sort of blaming your siblings, because it's often not intentional. That's what's really important here, that, you know, people are not sort of intentionally trying to set out with this idea of you picking up all the pieces. Having said that, it doesn't mean that it has to continue. In fact, it's really important, like I said, you know, that the earlier you sort of intervene and start to make change, the better. So really, it's looking at, I'm very interested in what this listener said about the loneliness. So step two is actually separating your dad's loneliness from your responsibility. And this is really hard because it kind of pulls at the heartstrings. And I think, you know, anyone who's lost a parent and sees the remaining partner on their own can relate. Like, it's very difficult to watch, especially if they were a close couple and they spent a lot of time together. But what we've got to remember in any relationship is that someone else's emotional, you know, feelings, their feelings are not our responsibility. In other words, we cannot take that on, because what happens is, and I think we can all again relate, is that we start to feel sorry for the person. You know, if you think someone's on their own, and my poor dad, and you start to feel this kind of pity, and that is actually energy that doesn't help at all. It doesn't help you and it doesn't help your dad in this case. You want to move away from that sort of empathetic distress and more into an empowering type of compassion, which is where you're really encouraging him. You're you know, really noticing how well he is doing, and then also providing genuine companionship, which is actually going to alleviate the loneliness much more than that feeling of worry or pity. Because think about it yourself, Claire, like, nobody, you know, you don't want to feel like someone's pitying you or worried about you in that way, because it just makes you feel even more isolated. Yeah. So I think it's really good to spend time with your dad, but the time is like lighter, funner, you know, maybe it's something he likes to do, like bringing it, going out into the garden, and just, you know, keeping things light is what actually really helps people in that situation.
I have like alarm bells ringing, red flags flying everywhere, because it's quite similar, you know, in my situation. I know, you know, you have your mom as well. But I think it's a lovely reframe for people, because even though we become carers of our parents, particularly, you know, as things really advance and care is needed, but to not feel like it's your responsibility to manage all of their feelings and to feel sorry for them, I think is a really important reframe. And I think it really helped this listener. What about step three?
Step three. OK, so this is where we're getting practical, Claire. We're going to call the family meeting. And this is so important. So essentially, once, like, what this is why there are steps. So once this lady has worked through her own emotional kind of, you know, where she is with this and calm down. So what we want is that resentment, that anger, that frustration is not sort of seething away quietly under the surface. And that understanding is there. And once you're feeling calmer, it's now time to actually be very, very proactive. And this is a huge part of compassion. It's like the yang side of compassion, where we're moving into actual being proactive. So calling a family meeting and really being very clear, because you're in a position actually where you have a lot of more control than you think that you do. You're the person that has been carrying the lion's share, and therefore you have the authority to say, look, everybody, you need to come on Sunday at this time. I really recommend getting out of anyone's particular environment, like not your home, not anyone else's home, but a neutral space is actually very helpful. So it could be, you know, a nice cafe, or it could be out in nature or somewhere separate from trigger zones, if you like. And what you want to do is just be very clear on why you've gathered the siblings together. And then the first step, and this is where it takes a lot of patience, is you want to hear their perspectives before you share your own. So this is really where you ask them, how do you think Dad is doing? And how do you see the future in terms of him getting older? You know, you said he's quite independent now, but, you know, that does change. And where do you see the future in terms of his care? So you just want to get an overview before you jump in. So once you've listened to everyone and been clear that we all need to listen, we're not interrupting, we just want to take it in turns here, you then share where you're coming from and really share from your heart in terms of how hard it has been for you, how you're feeling in terms of it's just too much. You cannot be expected to do all of the hospital visits that you're, you know, his main companion, etc. And then you say, we're going to work on a roadmap. We're going to get this really, really clear that we're all playing our part. Otherwise, if we don't do that, what happens is you start to slip into the martyrdom. And, you know, this again is where we need to be very accountable for our own behavior. It's not intentional, but we can kind of, it's like almost, it's a little bit strange, but we can kind of take pleasure in being the person who is the responsible one, you know, being validated. Oh, you're so good. I know you'll do it. And even though we're not happy about it, it seems quite nice to get that validation. So you've got to be honest with yourself and say, look, this needs to be broken up like a piece of cake equally, right? So we all take our responsibility. Because if we don't do that, what happens is, you know, a shared responsibility, if it's not defined, becomes just absolutely chaotic. And that one person will end up, and that is this lady, will end up taking the lion's share. And it's just not fair, because essentially, what can happen, and I've seen it in my clinic, is that person starts to burn out. They can get themselves, you know, ill, exhausted, and then they also now become someone that needs to be cared for. Mm. So we've got to be really proactive.
And resentment builds. And then, you know, look, unfortunately, it's only going one way. Eventually, this parent will pass. And then that's a very sensitive time, and all of these things start bubbling up at that time, and it's no time to be really getting into it. Whereas if, as you said, if things have been ironed out, or at least there's been open communication earlier on, it puts everybody in a stronger position. What if you've got differing opinions, which you're bound to have? I get an inkling from this email that, you know, some of the siblings think maybe paying for professional carers to come in and out might be a better way to handle it rather than them doing it personally. So how do you manage where you've got one sibling?
Got a point there.
One sibling thinks, no, it has to be us. This is what Dad likes. This is what Dad needs. And someone says, no, why not? You know, not throw money at it, but why not have a professional? Because we are all busy and we don't want to burn out either. We'll still call and see Dad. But how do you manage those differing opinions?
Well, I think you need to be very open, and, you know, it's like dealing with what it is, like I said earlier, what it is inside yourself. Like maybe this listener can feel lonely herself, and that's why it's kind of triggering, you know, so dealing with your own emotional well-being first and foremost. Because I do feel like, you know, we do need, like, a family who is stepping into that role needs support. Like, you want to keep relationships positive. You are there as a companion and a guide, but you don't want to be so thick in the caring that, you know, resentment starts to build. And so I think that the siblings have a point, and that could really help this lady to be open to that. And, you know, it sounds great that there is financial security there, and that's a good thing. You know what I mean?
Yes. So I'm conscious we have two more steps to go. Tell us what's next.
Well, step four is really building that plan together and kind of, you know, not taking on the role, even though that is the one you've played for so long, but saying, okay, so, you know, this week you're in charge of it. So you're not constantly being the person to remind others, because then that becomes like another chore, if you like. So, you know, it's like a month plan. If there's four siblings, week on week, you know, each person takes a week, and they're responsible for making sure that the father is cared for. If there's a hospital appointment, it's their turn. You know, include them in family things, like make sure that if there's a match on, one of the grandkids are playing, you know, suggest that he comes while he still can, you know, really sort of optimize this time, because it is precious. So I would say that has been very clear in the plan. Then step five is back to where we start and always finish, and that is protecting your own well-being. And this is really a non-negotiable, and I've had to work hard with clients over the years to help them really stick to this. And I know myself, it can be so hard to do it when you're in the thick of you know, caring and responsibility. But you have something in your life that is a non-negotiable for yourself, whether that is, you know, it's a sea swim, it's time with your friends, it is a yoga class, whatever your thing is that you keep it there and you hold it tight, because we actually need it more when we're under stress. We actually need that release. And rather than letting that go, you hold on to it tighter than ever before. And that takes real commitment to yourself, but it is one that everybody benefits from. So step five is really protecting your own well-being. And I say step five, but it's step one, it's step two, three, four, and five. That's always our number one. We have to look after ourselves so that we are that tower of strength and love and compassion for everyone around us.
Yeah. And look, we send lots of love. Myself and Fiona have both lost our dads. I we've been on this journey, and, you know, it's something that just came to me there, which makes me sad in a way. You know, I had a brilliant communication with my brother and sister. They were both still living in Ireland at the time when my dad was unwell. With my mum, we all communicated, we all put a plan in place, we all shared it, we all listened and felt heard. And it was great, but there were times where it was very, very stressful. And my kids will often talk about me being stressed at that time and me being angry at that time. And you don't realise how much your feeling is seeping out into the other areas of your life, no matter how much you think you're handling it. So it's so important that we do try and mind ourselves within all of this. The advice you've given is not airy fairy, because I know there are people in the thick of it saying, oh, for God's sake, that's all well and good, but, you know, my brother this, my sister this, my father that. Yeah. It's really important, because it does start to seep into your life.
Yeah, good point, Claire. You know, how it can be pervasive then, and the impact it has on everything. And that's what you want to prevent, that it doesn't spill out like that, that you're somehow managing to contain it through these steps, you know, being very practical, but also very compassionate to yourself first and foremost. Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing advice as always. And Fiona, you are opening up your online clinic in September. It's the first time in a long time that you've had space.
It is. Yes, absolutely. So you can book directly on my website, thepositivehabit.com, or find out more on Instagram on The Positive Habit. And essentially, yeah, it's my clinic that I've been running for many years. And I've added a few more spaces just recently. So if anyone is interested in one-to-one work, this is your opportunity now.
Therapist Fiona Brennan from The Positive Habit. Love you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Chile's Ballet de Santiago and their Swan Lake are at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin from next week. Cesar Morales is the artistic director of the ballet company, having danced with them and all over the world. So what does it take to be the best? Does living out your dream of a life on stage compromise your health and well-being? Well, I can ask him, because he's on the line now. Cesar, you're very welcome.
Hello, thank you for the invitation.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a dancer, Cesar?
Oh, I mean, from when I was a little child, I always wanted to do something to be in the arts, but I didn't really know if it will be dancing. I did a lot of things. I even liked to sing, draw, painting, and I did that from very early age. But at some point, I got to the theater and I have the opportunity to see ballet for first time. And it was after that really that my world changed. Like, I just saw this, and for me were like superheroes. And I said, I really, really want to be like them. I want to do that. And that's how it started.
And I was talking to a friend of mine recently whose son had an audition to be a professional ballet dancer recently. And we got talking about boys and dance and ballet. And I was saying that I think we've come so far. And I still feel, however, that it's more acceptable for a girl to play football than it is for a boy to dance. I don't think that's right. But are things different in Chile? Did you come against that a little when you were growing up?
When I was really young and I started in the ballet school, I did this kind of audition to get to the school, and I was the only boy 11 years old trying to get in. All the others were over 18 when they can just then decide if they want to do it. So it was before it was difficult. I think it was more difficult than now. Now people is starting to understand and seeing more things that you see it online everywhere. You see what the dancers do, but it still is not equal. Obviously, always it's more girls that come to the ballet school than boys. But I think the world is changing because if you think now, many big stars in ballet world are men. It's male dancing, male technique, like big jumps, a lot of turns, and that really attracts people. So it's changing, but it's still not the same.
And as you said, on stage, they're like superheroes, and it's so true. It's such talent. What about turning professional then? At what point did that happen in your life?
That was after, I mean, my first contract with Ballet de Santiago, because I started in Ballet de Santiago, I was 16 years. And that was after I had a scholarship in Houston Ballet in Texas, in Houston Ballet Academy. So I went there at 15, I studied for a little bit less than a year, I come back, and it's when Ivan Nagy, the director at that time, he saw me, and he offered me a contract to be in the company. I was very young age. I was the youngest at the time, and it was a big change of life. But I remember very well seeing all these principal dancers. Like, it was a huge thing for me, like, because I used to watch them from the school, and now working in the same studio daily, it was a big change.
This was an amazing opportunity, but did it come at great personal sacrifice? As you said, you were very young, you were living far away from home. How did that feel?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you see it. For me, there were not sacrifices because it's what I wanted to do. I was so happy doing it and I loved it. I remember going to normal school and just wanted to get off and take the bus just to come back to ballet school because I wanted to be in the ballet school and afternoon. So it wasn't sacrifices, but it's true that if I think that now, yes, I was really young. I left my family at 15 to go to another country. I had to stop my studies from the normal school that I finished later in at night, because I used to work in the company all day. At night, I was studying, finishing my school. And yeah, it's an effort, but when you do it and you see what it comes after or what you get, I don't see it like a sacrifice. It's what we decide to do, it's our passion, so we do it.
What about then the toll on you physically? Is that the same? Because there's a stereotype of the many hours spent rehearsing and training and pushing your body to the limit, the bandaged feet. But does all that fall into the background because you're doing what you love?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we are athletes, and athletes need to be this high level of intensity to show. I mean, a ballet dancer is a very, very strong athlete, and that's why it looks so easy, because that is very, very difficult to make it happen. It's all strength in your muscles, yeah, it's a work that you need to do it at high intensity. But in my days, we didn't have all what dancers have now. I mean, now you have Pilates, gyrotonics, and even when you go to a gym, you have more information on how to keep your body better, stronger, and in a safe way to do it. So I think now the dancers have a longer career than before.
And how many hours would be dedicated, say, for Swan Lake? now? What are the sort of hours that go into rehearsals?
Well, for example, a normal day in this company, you start at 10:15 and you finish like 15 minutes to 6 in the afternoon. But that have an hour 15 that is the normal class, ballet class that every company, every dancer does every day, just to get your body going and ready to do the job. And then you have a series of rehearsals. So the dancers are not all that amount of hours in continuing dancing. They have breaks for lunch. They have here in Santiago, you have an hour and 15, then you have 10 minutes free, then you have an hour 15. But you separate in groups as well, because when you have a big production at Swan Lake, for example, it's good to take the swans in the morning. So you work with them in the morning, and in the other studio you have principals. It's moving all the time. It's not that they're, for example, the swans doing the work of the white act all day. It's not like that. But you need all the amounts of hour to start rehearsing every piece separately. And now, for example, that we are just a few days to go to Dublin, now we started yesterday just putting all together. So now they're running the ballet.
And how is it looking?
It's looking great, of course. No, it's looking great.
Beautiful.
Everyone is working really, really hard. It's always going on tour is difficult because it's not dancing in the same theater that you dance every day, or every month on the same stage. The weather, the food change, you don't sleep in your bed. It's very different, but it's very exciting. I mean, in my career, I was in two big companies that they were touring companies. And it gets a little bit of time to get used to be moving all the time, but it gives you a strength and a capacity very strong. I mean, make dancers very strong, and it gives them, I don't know, it pushed them to continue and not to be always in the same place. They love to dance with other audiences, in other theaters, see other places, other countries. So it's a beautiful opportunity to do this.
And this show is all about health and wellness. And I talk a lot about finding joy in life, finding something that gives you joy, and finding something that puts you in a flow state. So for some people, it might be painting, and it doesn't have to be professional. For some people, it's swimming in their local gym. I'm sure there's many times on stage or when dancing that you're in a flow state. Can you put into words how that feels for you and what that means for you?
Well, I mean, to have a career and to live in this world inside of art, we live like with magic all day, to be honest. It's a beautiful thing. I mean, it's something that takes a lot of you. You have to put a lot into this to make it happen. But when you do it with your heart and you really have this passion, it's that it makes the difference. Because if you do these kind of jobs just because you want a payment at the end of the month, it's very hard. It's very hard to do it because, like to be doing repetitions of the same things one and another time, you have to have the passion to do it. But it makes you happy, and then you can give it back when you pass to the other level, that is a ballet master or whatever, anything you want to do in your life. I think that the career, the dancer's career, it gives you a lot for anything you want to do after. It gives you the pushing, the strength, and you know how to put yourself in place, to keep your nerves down, and I think it makes you a stronger person.
Yeah, dance is the universal language.
Yeah, it is.
And I also think the arts plays a huge role in our well-being, going to theater, going to see dance,
Yeah.
looking at art. What would you say to somebody who's never been to ballet before and thinks perhaps it's not for them, it takes a particular kind of person? What would you say to them?
They always gonna feel something, and anything they feel is already the job done for the dancers or for us, the company.
I love that. And if it is your first time, I think Swan Lake is a great one to go to, whether you're a regular ballet fan or a first time. And Ballet de Santiago's Swan Lake is at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin from the 18th to the 23rd of August. Artistic director and dancer Cesar Morales, thank you so much for coming on.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Mo Gilligan is well-known UK comedian and TV star of Gogglebox, The Masked Singer and many, many more. He's taken a serious turn with Big Chicken, a fast food conspiracy, his first documentary for Netflix as he investigates our global fried chicken obsession and the hidden costs behind our cravings. A lover of the food, Mo puts his body to the test in an experiment by eating fried chicken 3 times a day for 28 days straight. Over the course of the month, he goes on eye-opening journey from South London to the United States to reveal the historical origins of fried chicken, the social, economic and industrial forces driving our mass consumption of it, from fast food chains to large-scale farming and the impact on our health, our planet and the way we eat. Here's a clip from the documentary.
I only remember one chicken shop growing up. Now, in the UK, there's over 6,000. This bird is big business, boy. I want to find out what this food is doing to our bodies and our minds. I'm going to do an experiment. 28 days eating nothing but fast food fried chicken.
And I'm delighted to say that Mo Gilligan joins me on the line now. Mo, you're very welcome. So, Mo, why did you want to make this documentary?
I think, one, I like fried chicken. That was always the entry point in it. Do you know what I mean? I was met with a food that I really like and I really love, and then had this conversation with the guys at Mindhouse, and it was just, we just had a chat. It wasn't even like presenting me this program. They was just like, you know, do you like fried chicken? I was like, yeah. And I was like, do you ever look at the health implications of it? And I was like, well, not really. And then it was this self-discovery that I was asking them questions, they're asking me questions. And then before you know it, I was like, oh, this sounds good. Even if I wasn't involved, I don't know what you're going to do with it. I would watch this. And then the minute Netflix were like, yeah, we like this and we'd like you to do it, I was like, oh, okay. Wow, my honesty is really making things happen. But I was very, very transparent. I said, look, you know, I'm not an investigative journalist. I'm a comic first. And that's the show that I'm going to give you. I'm going to be myself. And they were like, that's perfect. That's kind of what we want. We don't want you to be someone you're not. And it was the perfect launch pad in some ways. I had my own reservations about it. You know, I felt self-conscious about eating food on TV, specifically fried chicken. My friends, again, when I told them about it, they were like, "Ooh, I don't know about that, man. Why are you eating fried chicken?" And that was something I felt really uncomfortable with. You know, there's a negative connotation that comes with that. I don't know where that came from. But then that was another reason why I kind of wanted to explore and see where else it would go. And the minute they were like, well, we want you to eat fried chicken every day. And I was like, that's fine. And I was like, no, for morning. I was like, oh, okay, well, that's it. No, for lunch. Okay, is this? Oh, no, we're going to do it for the dinner. So eating it for 3 meals a day was like, oh, how bad can it be? Can't be that bad. And then it got bad. It got really bad, Claire. But that was basically, in short, the kind of launch pad for me to make this film, Big Chicken.
And did you worry, being someone who's known for being funny and fun, to come in with something serious, especially with something that people love? You're that guy. You were like, it's only a bit of chicken. It's fun. I love it. And yet you were going to put on an investigative journalist hat.
Yes. And I say at the beginning, I'm like, I'm not an investigative journalist, but yeah, you know, it's always interesting when you say, like, I'm not. And then before you know it, you are doing the thing that you didn't know you set out to do. And again, everything, it felt like it happened very organically, you know, just kind of understanding more. You know, when you're traveling, you're meeting people, people that are affected by it, people that, again, work within, you know, some of the factories, the poultry factories. And you hear these stories that kind of break your heart. And you're like, oh, my God, I want to know more. Why don't people know this stuff? I know it. And I know I'm going to go back and tell my friends. So the fact we was able to document it just felt a little bit more powerful in some ways. Tell a story for people that can't have their story being told. So that's when you start realizing, OK, I'm an investigative journalist now. And any minute now, I'm going to be doing that to the camera to keep rolling, you know. So it was a very, what's the best word to describe it? Intense, but also the self-discovery in it was something I'll never forget. And the fact everyone got to view it felt even more special.
And I do think bringing that humor, not only does it provide a bit of light relief, it's nice to see you being you with
Oh,
food
thank you.
scientists, or, it just
Yeah.
breaks it up. Plus, I think it's really commendable that you're using your platform to bring about change, and people are going to listen to you more than they might, somebody, one of the talking heads, the experts, if you want to call them that. So I think it's really commendable, and that's how real stories should be told. Let's talk about the eating of the chicken.
Yeah.
So what were the rules? Breakfast, lunch, dinner, no vegetables, no fruit, no exercise.
So breakfast, lunch, dinner, it had to be from a fast food outlet and I couldn't exercise. I didn't obviously take any supplements. But yeah, breakfast, lunch and dinner, that was, I didn't have any fruit, didn't have any salad. And it had to be from a fast food place, which, when you go to America, you can get things like Chick-fil-A for breakfast. Or whether it was here in the UK and I'm waiting outside the chicken shop, 10:30, 11 o'clock, waiting for them to open up. Yeah, it got real very quickly when I was like, oh my God, we're doing this again. And the crew a lot of time would just bring, they'd be like, oh, here you go, here's your food. And I'm like, oh right, we're really doing this. Like, we're really doing it. Some of them tried to test me as well. I have to give praise to, we have a cameraman called Teo. And one day we was in Chicago, was sitting in the car and they're like, oh, we're all gonna go and get ramen. Do you wanna come? And I was like, there's no point because I can't eat none of the food, so there's no point. And he's like, it's all right, I won't say anything, it's fine. I was like, no, Teo, I have to eat this food all the time. And he was like, oh no, I was just testing you because I film a lot of these docs. And he even said to me, he's like, yeah, people don't really go through it. Like they don't actually do the thing, you know? And I was like, well, I do. So I don't know about everyone else you film. And he was like, oh, ramen, it's really commendable. Like, yeah, you're really doing this. And I did. I had to see it, had to see it through. Otherwise, we would have been filming something that wouldn't have made any sense if I didn't know the effects of it on my body, you know?
And it wasn't just your body. That's one of the things that surprised me most about this documentary was the impact on your mental health. Did
Yeah.
that surprise you? I think everybody knows you're going to gain weight, your
Yeah.
markers are going to change, and that's still an important conversation. But you're breaking down in tears, and you don't look the same. It's like your spirit has gone a little.
Yeah, no, I think I was drained of all joy. I didn't know it would have that effect on my mental health so soon as well. You know, I think by day 10, so I'm kind of fed up with this now. But yeah, it probably done more damage to my mental health than it probably done to my physical health, because I feel like I knew it would take a toll on my physical health. I knew I'd get a little bit bigger and stuff, and my face would, kind of get a bit chubbier. But mentally, I didn't think it would do that. I just didn't. I was just like, it probably would maybe a bit in longer, but not in this space it did. And that was for me the hardest part of the whole journey, hence why I would never do it again. I couldn't put myself through that mentally. It just wasn't fun.
And the doctor you speak to says the really good point that what about teenagers that are eating this way, that can't make sense of it the way you can? It was an experiment, you were noticing it, you were observing it, whereas some people are eating like this all the time. And that was the other thing that really shocked me the most, although there are lots of shocking learnings in the documentary, was fast food deserts, food deserts, places where there is no choice for people, particularly low-income families. And that's another thing that had an impact on both of our mental health. That's really sad that there's parts of America, and as you're saying, so many of the chains are coming into the UK and across Europe, that's going to happen too, that there's going to be areas where people don't get a choice between what they're eating for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It can be fast food all the way.
Yeah, it's happening a lot more. And the term food deserts, started in the UK. It was started in a place in Glasgow, was when they discovered what a food desert was. And as much as it happens in the UK, happens here. And I think it was really important for us to tell a story here and a story there, because America are great at exporting so many things to the world, whether it is entertainment, but also when it comes to food, and especially fast food. So yeah, it's really important that we can kind of see these things for what they are and understand the terms, because I was quite naive in thinking a food desert was just a place in the middle of nowhere and they only have fast food to eat. Where realizing that, I soon to realize, I was like, well, this is very heavily densulated, populated places with a lot of people there. but their food options are just fast food. And to go and get fresh fruit and vegetables is few and far between, you know. And I grew up in an environment where we did have markets and you could go to these places. And this is places where your mum and, you know, you go with your mum. But when me and my friends would go and play football, we'd go and get chicken and chips. You know, we didn't have a poke bowl or, you know, or some.
Acai.
Yeah, we didn't have that, you know. And I've drive through some of the wealthiest areas in where I'm from in London, and you see that there's a sushi pop up and stuff. And then I go to some of the areas that are not as wealthy in London, and you know, you see kids and they're going to get chicken and chips. And that's their daily meal, and they eat it every day. And you know, for some people they would say, oh, it's all right, because I know at home we've got the healthy food. But if they filled up on eating chicken and chips, they might not want to eat whatever the healthiest food is. You know, I was always aware of the term at home of like, you know, there's always rice at home. I'm like, yeah, but there's always chicken and chips outside. So you could weigh them up of saying, we've got this stuff here. I grew up having things like plantain, rice, chicken, home cooked meals. But, you know, 6 weeks holiday, I was like, well, I don't want to go home and eat that. I want to have chicken and chips where my friends are, because that feels a lot cooler. So yeah, that's just only going to intensify in the next couple of years. So if young people can watch this and see those patterns in themselves, that would always be quite cool as well.
Yeah, what do you hope will change? Because they talk about the power of social media in the documentary and how food trends, you know, people are losing their life in queues for new chicken sandwiches. Are
Yeah.
you hoping that clips from this documentary will cause change in behavior, policy change? What do you hope comes about?
Yeah, I think that would be amazing if it did happen. You know, if these were conversations that people could have higher up in maybe Parliament, I think that'd be really important. But I think it's got to start ground level at just having the conversation, whether that is in the home, in the workplace, in the WhatsApp group with your friends, seeing things that you can't unsee now. I think that's where it's going to change, and it's going to change in all aspects of society as well. You know, this isn't a problem just for, you know, black people or just working class people. This is a problem in every aspect of society. There are people that have money to buy, you know, go to the butchers, for example. And if the change for them could be, you know what, I might start investing in more grass-fed chicken, that's great, you know, because that's making a change to the environment. You're eating healthier. But I understand there's also people that can't afford to buy grass-fed chicken. It's very expensive, even organic chicken in the supermarket. But if it moves them to buy organic chicken and they make their own fried chicken in their house, and it takes it back to the roots of where it's from in the south, of cooking it as a southern dish with your family and your friends, then it stops your little brother or little sister being like, I need to go and get chicken and chips when I can actually make this for myself after school. So there's so many conversations to be had, but I think that's where it's going to start at a surface level. This isn't about, you know, oh, you need to be vegan, or why do you eat meat? I think we can have a conversation that can really help both of us.
Have you changed since making the doc?
Yes, I have. I think I didn't eat chicken probably for about 6 months until I once I was like, I don't need to eat this. I do not need to eat this. There's no reason for me to be like, I get a cheeky couple of wings or, you know, a chicken sandwich. So I didn't eat it for about 6, 7 months. It's definitely changed my habits. Weirdly now, when I look at, you know, a piece of chicken in the supermarket, I look at, where's it from? You know, is it organic? I'm quite fortunate enough that I'm able to do that, though. I understand people aren't fortunate. So yeah, it's definitely changed my habits. There's some things I can't unsee now. But yeah, I think I've really submerged myself into it. So I also have to be careful amongst my friends that I'm not being over preachy, because then people are like, all right, bro, chill out, calm down.
Yeah.
We've all got a Netflix film. I get it. So yeah.
This is one well worth watching. It's called Big Chicken, a fast food conspiracy. It is on Netflix now. I urge you to watch it, have conversations. Mo Gilligan, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aoife Breen, to all of my guests, to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound, Rory Galvin was on podcasts, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.